Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with the making of a terrorist in 2013. Scott Atran is interviewed by Chris Mooney. Scott Atran is an anthropologist and a leading expert on terrorism and violent extremism. He's done field work with terrorists and Islamic fundamentalists, as well as political leaders. Scott Atran is the author of the book, Talking to the Enemy, Faith, Brotherhood, and the Unmaking of Terrorists. And then after that, Cesar Chavez Commonwealth Club speech. Cesar Chavez was an American farm worker, a labor leader, and civil rights activist who co-founded the United Farm Workers Union. His birthday, March 31st, has become Cesar Chavez Day, a state holiday in California, Colorado, and Texas.
On the show this week, we talk to anthropologist and expert on terrorism, Scott Atran, about what makes a terrorist.
Welcome to Point of Inquiry. I'm Chris Mooney. Point of Inquiry is the radio show and the podcast of the Center for Inquiry, a think tank advancing reason, science, and secular values in public affairs. Back in the summer of 2011, just before the 10-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, this show welcomed on the air Scott Atran, an anthropologist who's a leading expert on terrorism and violent extremists. Now, in the wake of the Boston bombings and the dramatic capture of the suspect Jahar Tsarnaev, we called Atran back again to talk about what is the first large-scale U.S. terrorist bombing since then. As Atran's research shows, the Tsarnaev brothers share a lot of parallels with other young, disaffected men who opt for extremist violence around the world. But Atran's broader conclusion from the past week may be kind of an unsettling one, because, as he will explain, when we devote such massive societal attention to a few homegrown terrorists, we ultimately might not be doing ourselves any big favors. Scott Atran is an anthropologist and an expert on terrorism, with appointments at John Jay College, the University of Michigan, and Oxford. He is author of the book Talking to the Enemy, Faith, Brotherhood, and the Unmaking of Terrorists. In his research, he has personally interviewed Mujahideen, members of Hamas, and the plotters behind the Bali bombing. Scott Atran, welcome back to Point of Inquiry.
Glad to be back.
Yes, it's a very timely moment to have you back because there's, you know, media swarm of attention about these guys, these brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers, who have just been apprehended. One of them was killed in Boston. And we talked 2 years ago about the kind of people who end up becoming terrorists and violent extremists. So how much do these guys fit the pattern, not fit the pattern?
Well, they pretty much fit the pattern. I mean, it's pretty much what I thought from the very beginning. I mean, they were sort of self-declared ordinary, what they were described as sort of regular Cambridge kids. Most of the most plotters, like the young men who carried out the Madrid or London attacks, or some of the homegrown plotters here, most of these homegrown jihadi plotters are just disaffected young men from diaspora immigrant communities. About 90% of attacks against the West are from a diaspora immigrant community. And they sort of first hook up with the broad sentiment against the global attack on Islam before they move into sort of narrow parallel universe, sometimes get an apartment together. Often they quit the mosque or are expelled because their interruptions of Friday sermons and discussions when they yell at the imam and others to put up or shut up for jihad just aren't tolerated anymore, so they're kicked out. And they start cutting ties with their former companions who they feel are too timid to act. They've become estranged from their wives and girlfriends. Sometimes they're Christians, as with one of the lead bombers in Madrid, or Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And then they cement their bonds with friends and family who are willing to strike. And they come out of their cocoon with a strong commitment to kill and die if necessary, but without any clear contingency planning for what might happen after the initial attack.
Well, that sounds like it matches it pretty closely, although I guess there's one thing that doesn't match here. The younger brother, I think if I'm going to pronounce his name right, it's Shokar. It doesn't seem like he withdrew because he was back at school the next day, and his friends say they never noticed any change in him. He seemed like he managed to not vanish from society.
Right. A lot of the times it's one of the people who are truly committed, they are able to bring or lose others into their cocoon, and some of the others sometimes maintain ties with the outside. That's, again, pretty common. These aren't cells, and they're not brainwashed groups. They're clusters of young guys, disaffected for one reason or another, who seek significance and meaning in their life, glory and adventure. They're usually guys in transitional stages in their lives. I mean, it used to be the old Al-Qaeda was well-educated, you know, mostly science-educated, as a matter of fact, engineers and doctors, because those are the people who usually lead revolutionary insurgency groups or terrorist groups. They're ideologically committed, and they usually beat out the police and the armies who operate on sort of typical reward structures of pay or promotion. But since 9/11, with the destruction of the Al-Qaeda core, it's sort of diffused into a mass movement, and it's the old Al-Qaeda were sort of action figures for these younger people who want to, again, find significance, who are in these transitional stages between jobs or girlfriends or students or immigrants. And they find significance in this because it's a pretty powerful call. But again, they're not cells by any means. They're just bunches of guys who are self-seekers rather than recruiters. And this is the case, you know, almost everywhere. You know, take Faisal Shahzad, you know, the guy who tried to blow up Times Square, or Major Hassan, who killed 13 fellow soldiers at Fort Hood. You know? So they're inspired by online rhetoric, in this case by Anwar al-Awlaki, sort of firebrand preacher at the North Virginia Mosque, who went to Yemen, was killed by a U.S. drone in 2011. And al-Awlaki used to say to these guys, look, you want to do something in the United States, and the way it works is, you know, there's this massive media, global massive media political awakening for the first time really in human history with the advent of the internet and cable news and social media, so that any place on earth can tune in with any other place on earth. And again, rather than a clash of civilizations, a resurgence of millennial territorial traditions, there's a collapse of them, and sort of the dark side of globalization. And young people are sort of flailing around looking for identity, and they match up vertically instead of horizontally through their elders and institutions with their peers. And they attach on to a very powerful and superficial message. Just to show you how superficial historically and ideologically it is. I mean, take the case of, you know, jihadis in Sulawesi or Borneo, which is, you know, between New Guinea and Malaysia, willing to and actually going to fight for die for jihad in Afghanistan or Chechnya or Uzbekistan or wherever, or Palestine. And these guys were literally cannibals three generations ago, even two generations ago. They're separated by 55,000 years of human history from guys in the Middle East, and yet they're willing to die for the guys in the Middle East. So it can't be because they share any deep traditions or history. It's got to be because they're hooking up in rather fast and superficially with this message, like Islam's being persecuted. Now, if that global message resonates personally with you, with your, you know, sort of frustrated ambitions, especially, which is especially the case with these youth in transitional stages in their lives, these emerging adults, then your personal frustration becomes a sort of moral outrage, and you're increasingly willing to act on it. Now, most people who, you know, the polls show that there are about 7% of Muslims who really support this stuff. That's a small minority, but still, out of 1.4 billion Muslims, that's almost 100 million people. But of those who actually do it, it's very, very few, you know, a few hundred in the United States, mostly actually in entrapment cases, a few thousand in Europe, where things are much more difficult for Muslims. And they buy into this message that Islam is being attacked. And the best predictor of whether they'll actually join up is, who their friends are. Especially if they're sort of action-oriented guys. In this case, you know, like Tamerlan and Jaha, you know, one was a wrestler and a soccer player, and the other was both a soccer player and a boxer. And Tamerlan especially, he had real issues with life in America. He was denied his citizenship. He felt, so increasingly isolated that he really didn't have many friends. His father was absent, which is, you know, frequently the case here. And then he found this as an avenue of an expression, and he brought in his brother. Mm-hmm. His brother loved him, right? His brother was devoted to him. That we find again and again and again. You know, 10 to 20% of all the people who join the jihad, well, about 90% who join the jihad in these attacks are diaspora community immigrants. About 10 to 20% are family members, mostly same generation family members. And about 60% are friends. And the rest are a mishmash of people who are actually foreign, or, disciples of others.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come.
and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Yeah, I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder,
ride on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Come on, the peace train. It's peace train, holy roller.
Everyone jump on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh. Come on, the peace train. Get your bags together. Come bring your good friends too. It's getting nearer, it soon will be with you. Come and join the living, it's not so far from you. And it's getting nearer, soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounding louder,
ride on the peace train.
Crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Oh, peace train sounding louder,
ride on the peace train.
Come on, the peace train. This peace train, holy roller.
Everyone jump up on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh, ooh,
ooh. Come on, come on, come on.
Yes, come on, peace train. Hey, yes, it's the peace train.
So would you call these guys amateurs? I mean, surely if you get actual sophisticated training in being a terrorist from somebody who knows something about it, you don't use your Twitter and YouTube accounts to draw attention to how you're feeling, right? I mean, if anyone had been monitoring them, then they would have known and they would have given up the game. So they're not that strategic.
No, no, they're certainly amateurs. What you find a lot of the time is that someone has a relative, or a friend or a friend who has a relative in one of these, you know, sort of hot spots, Chechnya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kashmir, Somalia, Libya, Mali, wherever. And most of the guys who try to link up with them never make it, or just don't have the money, or are caught. But some guys do, especially if they're off the radar. And then they hook up with, you know, some da'is or some imam or some firebrand ideologue or preacher. And they may get some, you know, sort of fast and superficial training, 10 days, sometimes 2 weeks. I mean, even if they make it up to the Afghan-Pakistan frontier, they're only going to get about 2 weeks. It's nothing like the old Al-Qaeda where there would be actually months, I mean, actual courses. Here you learn to, you know, make a bomb, maybe push a plunger, shoot a gun, and that's it. So then basically the guys who motivate them, you know, they're already self-seekers, right? They're already sort of psyched up to do this thing, or at least move to radical, to some radical stage, because they think everybody else is just talking and it's time to act. And basically the guys overseas who they hook up with say, okay, now go home and blow up something. Here's an idea. you know, or they'll give them a link to an internet page where it says, you know, make a bomb out of a pressure cooker, which is both in the Al-Qaeda manual and the anarchist cookbook. And then there might even be some emails back and forth. That's when the NSA, our authorities, usually pick them up. Or the guy just remembers what to do and then starts making them. He's intelligent enough. I mean, this guy, Tamerlan, he wanted to be an engineer, so he's probably smart enough to be able to figure this out. It's all on the internet anyway, how to do it. The ingredients are fairly simple. And then you just go ahead and do it. But then you don't really have a plan what to do afterwards.
So given that this is, as you're saying, sort of the primary route towards, you know, violent extremists and then actually launching an attack, are we trying to detect them the right way or not?
Well, the United States has pretty good intelligence and we're pretty plugged in. And especially, you know, groups like the NYPD are really good, really good at following leads and tracking them down. In fact, it's surprising how few successful attempts there have been, exactly one in the last 12 years, despite efforts by lots of guys. But here's the thing. I think that our intelligence is adequate and our police work is adequate. What isn't adequate is the preparation of the citizenry, because the philosophy, the political philosophy, is that there has to be zero tolerance of terrorism. Now, you can't have zero tolerance of anything, really. I mean, maybe smallpox, like zero tolerance, wipe it away. But, even in epidemics, zero tolerance is just wishful thinking. You know, you try to live with it and get it to be as small as possible. But the attempt to reduce it to zero tolerance, which is an impossible task, leads to mass hysteria and waste of resources. About 1,000 to 1 in terms of the resources we've committed compared to the costs that the terrorists have incurred, and about something less than one an order of magnitude in terms of the casualties and killings that our reaction has caused compared to what terrorists have caused. And that's just, you know, unsustainable. Luckily, it's rare enough so that, you know, it passes like a great tidal wave. But I mean, it's sort of nuts.
Well, are you saying then that the last week was an overreaction? I mean, you could see it from the perspective of the police when they don't know where that guy is and they don't know. They think he has bombs. And they think he's going to use them. They shut down the city. I mean, then everybody gets completely freaked.
That's right. So the president declares, you know, he says, you know, Americans refuse to be terrorized. And ultimately, that's what we'll remember from this week. You got to be kidding. You know, believe that and I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. I mean, the bombings provoked the most intense display of law enforcement and media coverage since 9/11. The place was in full lockdown. The headlines screamed, you know, ghost town, city in terror, war zone. Public transportation was stopped. A no-fly zone was proclaimed. People told to stay indoors. Schools and universities closed. Hundreds of FBI agents pulled from, you know, really other pressing investigations to exclusively focus on the case. 10,000 law enforcement officials, other state and city agents, heavy weapons, armored vehicles, helicopters, planes, all close to martial law, with the tools of the security state mobilized to track down, you know, a couple of young immigrants with low-tech explosives and small arms who failed to reconcile their problems of identity and so became amateur terrorists. You know, the events were shocking and brutal, but this is, of course, you know, part of the overall U.S. reaction to terrorism since 9/11, where, you know, I think perhaps never in history have so few armed with so few means caused so much fear in so many. It's like the anarchists a century ago. It's precisely the outsized reaction that sponsors of terrorism have always used to terrorize.
So how do you reverse that?
The buildings look like boxes on the sand. They blow up and then you clap your hands. But the people that were hit, did you think of it? You know, the stuff films on the nightly news with all the expert point of views. The snuff films on the nightly news with all the expert point of views. The crosshairs make it look so clean and neat. Grab the popcorn, come on, take a seat. The captain calibrates the fix and it dials in the track. The stealth machine is a working fine, fools the brown guys every time. The stealth machine is working fine, fools are brown guys every time. So it's bombs away and roll a video. The vector's locked and so he turns to go. The captain's thinking bars look good with his wings, and the silver shape is a gliding down for the target in the town. A silver shape is gliding down for the target in the town. Child turns to face the sudden sound. A flash of light, what's happened to the ground? Then she's flying high, like the captain in the sky. Oh, but when she lands, she's a very still. It's accidental, if you will. But when she lands, she's very still. It's accidental, if you will. Roll a tape, the graphics are sublime. They play between the traffic and the time. But how many pairs of eyes shut as hard as stone while you watch the captain soar and you shout it out for more? While you watch the captain soar and you shout it out for more. The buildings look like boxes on the sand.
And now for something completely different.